Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to Second Chance Podcast. This is episode 64, and my guest today is none other than the talented Brenda Burungi, aka Lady Unchained. Love that tag. Brenda's passionate about second chances and is an important advocate for life after prison, having been sentenced to 2.5 years inside at the age of 21 for a violence offence. She's since become a poet, a facilitator, a mentor, and a radio host for National Prison Radio. Brenda is also founder and creative director of Unchained Poetry, an artistic platform for people with lived experience of the criminal justice system. She's also the host of Unchained Nights, a night of inspirational storytelling through poetry and music. Brenda's poetry workshops in prisons and in the community for women centres helps women find their creative voices. Although she's out of prison and living her best life, she continues to challenge the ex-offender label through creativity. Thanks for coming on my podcast. It's really great to have you here. And
you're welcome.
We first met, gosh, I don't know how long ago it was now. It must have been 3 or 4 years ago. I can't believe that time has passed. But we first met when you came along and you and I had a chat about, you know, your aspirations, having not left prison very long ago. Tell me a little bit, Brenda, about how your career has developed since that first conversation you and I met. I think it was at the O2 in Greenwich, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Do you know what? Like, it has actually grown. So, like, I think I remember you saying, you're going to get there. And don't forget, you know, your background and where you've come from, but you are going to get there. And I think I smiled because I believed it. And I do believe that good things are going to happen. But when you've been back and forth, sometimes it's like you need somebody else to tell you, you know, you're going to get there. It's somebody that doesn't, you know, you don't have no contact. You don't need to please me. You don't need to say nice things. You know, you're not my mum, my dad, my brother. Like, you don't need to say this stuff. So when you, after that day, I remember kind of talking to Jude and kind of going, okay, I need to do this like properly. So I have written a book, Raphael. I've written a book of poetry called Behind Bars. And it's basically taking you through the journey, so before jail, in prison, and after life after prison, and that will be coming out next year, July. So that's happened, and that's something I never really thought I could do. I think I kind of put a barrier on myself in regards to, yes, I'm a poet, but I'm a self-taught poet, so I kind of didn't see, like, my grammar. I didn't feel like for a book it would be enough, but I've got a publisher. They reached out to me and now I've written this book, so that's done. I've also done a documentary on Holloway, so I had the opportunity to go back into Holloway with a group of women who once lived in Holloway. And we kind of walked through Holloway, knowing that Holloway is now closed, 2016, it closed down. It's an empty space. And I remember having all these emotions that I thought I left in Holloway. And now that documentary's basically been done. We've kind of explored how do women get there and how does it feel to actually be in Holloway? And it was interesting, actually, for me. Something that I learned in jail was that, you know, people go back. They come out of jail and they come straight back. And I remember when I was in prison, kind of thinking, why do they keep coming back? You know what? You know, I remember even asking the officer, sir, like, if you give me the next lady's release date, I promise you I won't come back. And he said, that's not how it works, Brenda. You know, that's just not how it works. But, you know, being on the outside after prison, I learned very quickly how easy it is for you to feel like prison is a safer option. And doing the documentary for Holloway, kind of that explored some of the women who actually felt safe when they got to Holloway, which is not my experience. My experience when I got to Holloway, I was afraid. I was very fearful. I didn't know who was going to, I had to fight to, you know, be the big boss. You know, you think about films, don't you, when you get to prison. So it was amazing to do that. And that's coming out next year as well.
And what channel will that be on?
We have no idea, Raphael. We have no idea. It's all kind of secretive at the moment. I think they are aiming high. They are aiming quite high. Fingers crossed it goes maybe Netflix, you know, something big. But I also done my own film. So I just finished recording this year alongside the Holloway documentary. We done a documentary about me. And it's called Budlia, The Unchained Story. So it's my journey going from, I guess, inmate to advocate. And it follows the people that I work with. So some of the artists that I work with, a mentor, you know, some of the artists that perform at Unchained Nights. But also it explored one in particular person who didn't actually go to jail. He's one of those guys that really kind of escaped prison. He saved himself, but he was literally on the road to prison at a very young age. And now he's this amazing artist, amazing mentor. And so I'm trying to motivate him to kind of start speaking to young people, I guess, in prison so that they can see where they fit with his story. And is there another direction that they could have taken to avoid this journey to prison? So it's been busy. I've also done Cookham Woods. I've done 7 weeks in Cookham Woods called Unchained Leaders Project. So trying to get young people to understand where they can be leaders and how they can become leaders. And it's also important for me to explain to them that the group of friends that they had, if they were the big boss, even though they're young kids, if they were the big boss and they had a group of people that followed them, they never really got the mentality to create a business, to have a leadership role. And it's just something for them to look into that experience and see life in a different view. So it's been busy. I've been literally touring prisons left, right and centre, Cookham Wood, Aylesbury, Pentonville. Hopefully I'll do some more next year. And I'm actually now the artistic director for the Cookham Wood project. So I've been promoted.
It sounds like you have been really busy, but that doesn't end there, does it? Because you're also the host of the National Prison Radio Show. What? Tell me about the radio show, because people often say when you leave prison, you kind of want to leave it behind. But sometimes that experience, and you're an advocate of that, you know, your advocacy in the work and the talent that you have, sharing that with other people is a purpose and it aims high. What about the prison radio? What are you doing on the National Prison Radio?
So I had two shows. So I had the original one is Free Flow. And that one, I actually picked that up. I got given that show during lockdown. So when the world went on standstill, and I remember asking my producers, I said, you know, it's an instrumental show. We play the instrumentals twice so that they can write and be creative during that time of the instrumentals playing. But what I decided during that time, especially because it was lockdown, I asked them, I said, look, is there any way we can ask them to call me in? You know, send me some bars down the phone line and I can advise them how they can, you know, create them and develop that writing skill and the technique. Also, it's all about positivity. So even with what I write, you know, I don't glorify crime. Even my artists, we're not allowed to, you know, I want you to talk about your experience, but don't talk about it in a way where you're glorifying it. So for them, it's listening to me say, okay, we're playing drill now, but can you write some positive bars? And actually, we have had some. We have not many, but we have had some. And that is literally once a week, every week. On Fridays, I record that. It goes out on Saturdays and Mondays. And it's just a way to communicate with the people in prison that what I do say to them every day, every time I speak to them, I say, you know, I want you to remember that I am you after a prison sentence. You know, I think for me, there was no map, there was no direction of what I should do after prison. Kind of being a part of National Prison Radio was literally by chance, being able to find people that knew about National Prison Radio that then told me about it. So I'm really there to kind of motivate them, help them be creative. And then just off the back of that, I got a spin-off show, which was called Bars. And that is basically the same show, but with a more, I guess we had artists, we had different guests, like celebrities. Let's say it right. We had celebrities on the show, artists, some that had been to prison, kind of talking back. So I mean, there was one interview with Hack Baker, you know, who has been to jail and picked up that guitar in prison. And it was just amazing for him to give his side of how he became creative in such a confined space, in such a space of like depression and anger. And that show actually won a gold award at the Audio Production Awards this year. and also Free Flow got nominated for at the Arias Awards, and we got a bronze for that. So we're getting there. And it's just, I guess for me, you're right. When people leave prison, they want to kind of forget about it and move on and just kind of like, just think that that's it now. I've got a new life. But actually it's really hard to do that when you're constantly reminded, you know, for example, applying for a job, you're constantly reminded you have to declare your, you know, criminal record. You know, you're going to an event, you have to, you know, driving licenses, insurance, all of these things are things that if you never had a criminal record, it's hard to maneuver your life out here when you never had this experience before. So it's kind of giving them motivation, but also showing them that they can build some kind of life after prison.
You use terms, I was reading some of the stuff around your journey, and you embrace the fact, and I think when we first met, as you said, my message is always, you know, don't hide from what you are, what happened to you, where you've been, etc. Use it if you can to your advantage. And your story starts from prison. You've mentioned it a few times that you ended up in prison, and that experience changed your life in many, many ways. But that's because you've taken the opportunity since you come out of prison. And that's where your story starts. I mean, obviously, it doesn't start with you going to prison because you lived a life long before went up in prison. And maybe that's the place to start. Who is Brenda? You know, where did Brenda grow up? What was life like before you ended up having your brush with the law that led to you going to prison? Tell me a bit about your background, Brenda.
So Brenda's from Southeast London. She's grown up in Southeast London her whole life. I don't even think I've ever lived in any other area. So I've grown up with my mum, three sisters and an older brother. Very, very tight family. I think my mum taught us from young that we just have to look after each other, you know, that there is us and we need to make sure we protect each other. So that was installed in me, you know, even going to school, you know, if I had an issue, my sister would come and talk to people or my brother would come and help me. And, you know, it was just that, like, it wasn't like it was a gang family fighting. We was just really there. You know, if you have a little sister and she's runs home crying, you're going to try and figure out what's going on. So, you know, I grew up in Southeast London with my family, but I also had an amazing group of friends. Two in particular boys who I saw as brothers, really. You know, they have now passed away. They passed away after I got out of prison. And that's something that I kind of regret in my own decisions in life, because I feel like being in prison, I missed that time to reconnect and create new memories that I could have been carrying today. And I was very, like, sporty. Everyone, it's funny now that I wear makeup and like get dressed up. People are like, that's not, you know, Brenda. Brenda, like, I was like tracksuit bottoms and hoodies. Like, you know, I was chilling with mostly guys. You know, I've got my best friends who are female, and I call them my sisters as well. But it's like we all kind of just acted like boys, if that makes sense. It was just very sporty. I actually remember my mum kind of saying to me, I'm not going to buy you new clothes no more, because I was that girl that would get new trainers and new tracksuit bottoms, and then I'll go outside and play goalie and I'll come back all muddied up. She's like, you know, my mum's an African lady. She's like, are you a boy? Are you a girl? I don't know what is wrong with me, you know? Like, so I was very sporty, but the one thing about me was that I still had long nails. That's the one thing, like, as for my, that was the feminine side of me. I would have long nails, and I used to play basketball, but if the nail broke, all the boys would just run away because they're like, oh my God, she's going to lose her mind. So I remember playing basketball and breaking my nail, and I'd be like, oh my God, the nail's broken. And I would look up and all the boys have gone, like, they're just scattered, just scattered. So I was very sporty, very, very happy. I think also I was always like smiley. I was very reliable. I remember being the child that my mum would say, if you need something done in the morning, ask Brenna to do it, because I'd wake up and I'll do stuff, you know, which is funny because now I hate mornings. But, you know, back then I was like the go-to person. And I also remember pocket money. For some reason, I always ended up having loads of pocket money. I don't know whether that's because back in the day, £5 credit will last you like a whole month. You know, you could buy a £5 credit, you know, was it 1-to-1 back then? You know, it was cheaper. And so my older sister and my older brother would always be like, oh, how much money you got left? And I'd borrow them £10 here, £10 there. And then by the end of the week, they pay me back and I've got like £50, which at the time is like, I'm rich, you know? So I feel like my childhood was like very much a joyful one. I went to all girls school, which is actually funny. Now I think about it, when I ended up in jail, that was the only time, like, being around women and loads of girls when I was in a girls' school for 5 years, you know. And that's the only time I really connected with loads of women, until I got to jail and had to kind of recalculate how I connected with these women to start with. So, yeah, I think I've had, like, a good childhood. And also I had one, like, brush with the law. I thought I was really like, oh, my God, I'm in trouble. I remember this is, like, before bike lanes, you know, when you can, like, ride your bike on the pavement. You know, you can't ride. You're not meant to ride your bike on the pavement no more because there's actual bike lanes. And I remember I thought I was cool, probably about 11 years old, got on the bike, drove in the road. And I remember the police officer kind of pulling me over and said, you're not allowed to ride your bike there. And I went, oh my God, I didn't even ride the bike home. I pushed it all the way home because, you know, I didn't want to tell my mum. I didn't want to say nothing. It was like, I was like, oh my God, I remember telling my friends, I nearly got arrested, you know, like, you know, oh my God, the police are going to arrest me. But that was it. It was nothing serious. Of course, going to a girls' school, there's always fights. Every other day. Like, I do remember one time somebody pulling out my hair. Like, I had like a whole bald patch here for like a while. Yeah, like, it, girls are vicious, you know. And I think this is why I just stayed with guys, because I was like, I don't know how to handle you, not, you know, you argue over everything. And because I wasn't really like the going out with boys kind of thing, they were more my friends. People would argue with me because they thought that these boys were like my boyfriends, like my best friend. Everyone thought that was my boyfriend, and people wanted to frighten me, and I'm like, this is not my boyfriend. He's just this, look, he takes like eye bogey out my eye. He's not my boyfriend, like, you know. So it was just like, had a nice little life, you know, back in the day when, you know, there was youth centers and you could go and people are DJing and doing stuff and everyone's MCing. And I remember, like, So Solid Crew, Miss Dynamite, oh my God, like, any dynamite, like, put on a dynamite track, I will just MC. So maybe I had that skill there with the poetry and the writing stuff there already. But in regards to poetry itself, I don't know if I really wrote poetry before jail. Like, I personally believe that it did come from prison. However, I loved English and I did quite well in English. Like, I did, I think I got like a B in English Lit. And like a scene in the whole rounded English language. So I was quite like, and I liked Shakespeare. Like, I liked the old words and learning old words that mean like this stuff that we know today, like wax apparently means sexy. Like, and I remember all of that, we're wax. Like, you know, so I was always very like intrigued with just like life and experiences and, you know, new people and dance. I done drama in school, like drama GCSE. I done music, you know. I was very, very like into the arts already, but I guess after school that kind of just goes down, because it was like my dream was to be an air hostess. I just wanted to fly away, get far away from here, you know, like, why, I don't know. Maybe I was running from deep dark emotions that I probably weren't ready to understand as a child, but I just wanted to fly away. And everything in my journey, I did it the right way. So I was like, okay, if I want to be an air hostess, I'm going to need to do travel and tourism. So I went and done travel and tourism in sixth form, passed. I got BTEC. Then I had to go to a different college to do the second level up, which was like travel and management organizations. So you're learning everything. And I've done that, passed that. That was a national diploma. And then, you know, I went to Virgin Trains for work experience, you know. So I kind of like had all these connections in my head. I knew what I wanted, how I had to get there. And there was a journey. There was a journey and there was a plan. Prison just wasn't a part of that plan at all. So that completely threw me over.
It sounds like you had quite an interesting growing up, you know, background. I know South East London because I'm from South East London, born, bred and still live there. So I know it very well, although it's big. And we don't have the tube beyond the Oval or Brixton. But it sounds like your friendship group, your plan, your ambitions were all kind of going in the right direction. Was the neighbourhood that you grew up in a tough neighbourhood, i.e. typical of what we talk about today, that there's lots of distraction, there's gangs, there's drugs, there's violence? Or was you, Brenda, someone who was able to, even though it was probably around you, navigate around that and not get caught up in that? Or did that eventually happen, which inevitably led to your going to prison? Or is there no connection?
There is actually no connection. Like, do you know what's interesting about that? Like, obviously, where I live, like, it wasn't, when I was growing up, it wasn't like so much gang affiliated. It's only as I got older and I realized, oh, you know, because I mean, I went to a girls' school, the boys' school was next, kind of basically like 10 minutes away. You know, all the boys were like boys that I'd gone to primary school with. And, you know, we all knew each other. And I remember a time when after school, there's always that local place where everyone meets up and goes to McDonald's. I'm talking back in the days when you can get two cheeseburgers for 99p, you know, like, you know, and two apple pies for 99p, those days, you know. So, you know, I remember all of us leaving school and, you know, meeting up in like Woolwich, and everyone's like, all the boys are together, all the girls are together, we're talking, you know. I remember like a particular time, and I don't know where this footage went, but I remember that some cameras came to our local area. So everybody was trying to get on TV. I remember the guys taking off their tops and like flexing their muscles and, you know, trying to put me in under their arm, like, stand, look pretty. Like, I don't know how to look pretty, you know? And I remember that was a good time. That was a time when all of these friends, all of my friends that I knew as guys, connected. They knew each other. And I think it was like the age of maybe 16, 17, things changed in the area. Things changed and, you know, the gangs became very visible. So guys that I knew that I could, you know, chill with together were no longer chilling together. You know, I was now being told, oh, you can't hang out with this person and you can't hang out with that person. And I remember going, listen, I don't know about your gang, this gang, whatever. Just the other day, we were sitting there playing basketball. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm going to hang out with him. You know, so I was very like not connected with it. I wasn't involved. And I remember kind of just really trying to understand what was happening. But it got real deep to the point that when I left my sixth form, which would have been the sixth form, which would have been in my local area, I decided to go to Lucian. I didn't want to be a Lucian person. Like, I'm not joining a Lucian gang. That's where my course was, you know, like, so I had to go to Lucian. And I remember all the guys going, oh, what? So you're going to like ghetto NJ, you're going to get, and I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm going to school. Like, they're like, so you're gonna start rolling with a ghetto man. Yeah, you're gonna, I'm like, listen, I don't know no ghetto people. Okay. Like, I just want to get an education. You know, there was a lot of stuff happening around then. But I know that because I was very outspoken, I didn't really believe in this, like, you're the bad man or whatever. You know, I do remember being kind of put in a situation where, you know, an older guy who I didn't know he was the big boss of the area, I just looked like a guy that was bothering me, you know. Like, you know, and I've obviously just, no, you can't talk to me like this. And I remember loads of the guys coming up to me later going, you need to be careful, that's the big boss, you know. And I'm like, the big boss of who? Like, is he God? Like, I don't understand, you know. And they're like, no, he runs the area. And I'm like, he don't run the area, he's not the MP. Like, I don't understand, how does he run the area? Like, you know. And they're like, Brenda, he's bad people, you know. And we had this whole issue where this guy just basically, for about a year, he would just like harass me or throw things at me. And I remember standing there thinking, what really have I done to deserve this, you know? And actually saying to my mum, you know, we need to move. Like, we might need to move, mum, because this guy is not, you know, he's not letting it go. But eventually he let it go, you know. But I've never really been in that. So when it came to, I guess, because of the way we were brought up in my family, we were just, you know, protecting each other. So if you want to call us a gang of family, yeah, we looked after ourselves, you know. So I think for me, I didn't need to be in a gang because I was already in a family that really protected me, that looked out for me, and I knew they had my back regardless. And also my best friends as well. Like, you know, I remember being caught up in situations where somebody will show up and they'll be like, hey, that's Brenda. And I didn't know who that person was. It's just that they knew me from somebody else kind of thing. So my fight had nothing to do with gangs, but it was very, what I would say is that once that fight happened, it nearly pushed me into doing certain things that would have kind of affiliated me with a gang, just because I had a fight in a nightclub. And growing up, like, I never really used to go clubbing. I was in quite a serious relationship before jail, which is just something that I just don't really speak about too much. But I was too young to be in that serious relationship, if that makes sense. Like, I was quite young to be in that. So once that ended, that's when I started going out and spending more time with my siblings again, because that had kind of stopped when I was in this relationship. So going out, you know, this was like the first time that I've now reconnected with my, you know, family. And this attack happened. It was so three women. I would have been 20 at the time. And it's funny. It's not even funny, but I have to laugh, because sometimes if I don't laugh, I'll just get emotional. Before this incident, I had stopped going to college and everything, right? So I was calculating what I should do, because I wasn't sure if I can be an air hostess anymore. You know, I think I remember looking at the job criteria and I thought, oh my God, I can't swim. I'm going to fail. Like, I'm going to fail the test. And I mean, I can swim, but I'm scared of the water. So I might just pedal a little bit at first and then it might go a bit crazy. But what I decided was, I remember a lot of my friends and family had children at the time. And I remember there was this struggle of like, oh, I don't have someone to look after the kid and childcare is really expensive. And somebody messaged me and said, oh, there's this course with the council's doing a child minding course. And I said, oh, like, how much do I have to pay for that? And they said, no, it's free. And I thought, whoa, you know, nothing's free in this world, really. So I jumped to that opportunity, and I remember going to the council and I applied. They accepted me, and I basically passed, and I was qualified to do all this stuff. And then what happens is, after you qualify, they then have to do inspections. So they had to come to the property, inspect the flat. And it's this same flat, actually. And what they say is, if you feel like there's things in your house that are not safe for children, just put up post-it stamps. So I remember the lady coming, I had like yellow, pink, green post-it stamps all around the house. And she passed me. She said, look, I have no reason to give you this pass. She said, you're going to have one more inspection. That will be with Ofsted. And then after that, you'll be a qualified childminder and you can start putting up prices and start a business. And I thought, great. And I remember literally a week later, this is when this fight happened. And I was in a nightclub in Southeast London, Old Kent Road, with my sister and a family friend. And I remember my sister had a bit of like trouble. You know, she was the one that would go out. I never went out. So she had issues with people. I would hear about it through the grapevine, but I wasn't really involved in it. And a lot of people didn't really know me. So this particular night, I don't know how to say this without sounding that so religious. Like, I refused to go to church. One of my promises growing up, because I grew up in the church, I was in the choir, I wrote songs, you know, Sunday school teacher. I promised God that I would not go to church on a Sunday and then go clubbing. However old I am, and this is me being a child promising God this, you know, and I said, I'll never go to church and then go to a club. That's really bad, God. I'll never do that to you. And I didn't do it for years. You know, I remember being asked, come to church, we're going clubbing. I'm like, nah, I'll meet you at a club. I'm not coming to church, I'll meet you at a club. And this particular day, I went to church. It was an evening service. I don't remember anything that the pastor said or whatever, to be honest with you. I just remember thinking about outfits and hair and makeup and what I was going to look like. And all I remember is one song in the service, and that's it. And this particular night, I remember being in the club. I was wearing a white dress with a long weave. You know, back in the day, I used to wear weave so much, like every single color of weaves, I had it. And I had like white, long weave, massive earrings, you know. And I remember my sister saying to me, she was going to say hello to somebody. I think there was somebody that my mum knows in the club or something. And she was going to say hello to that person. And I remember kind of watching her walk away and then kind of looking away for a minute. But I had realized that the women she had beef with were kind of on that same side, but she went a different side. So I thought, okay, she's all right. And then I remember looking away and looking back, and then somehow these women had kind of swerved, like they'd really drifted towards where she was standing. And I just thought, this ain't really going to be a thing, is it? You know, like I'm, you know, I wasn't a drinker back then. So I'm like sipping like champagne. I don't even like champagne now. I'm sipping champagne, you know, 20 years old. And it just happened so quickly. Like it just, you know, clubs, especially in Old Kent Road, that they get so packed out. So it just looked like there was like commotion. It didn't really look like something serious was happening until I literally saw my sister, like, with, you know, her head down and, you know, this girl's like, they're just hitting her. And honestly, Raphael, my intention when I went there wasn't even to fight. Like, it actually wasn't to fight anybody. And I remember something that I did was I poured drink on her. I don't know why in my head I thought that would make sense. I don't know, maybe because I've seen when you're drunk or you're out of it, people pour water on you, and I thought maybe that might help. No, it didn't. It just kind of made everything worse. And she kind of just continued doing what she was doing. And I'll be honest, in that moment, right after that, I can honestly say that I blacked out, because I don't actually remember hitting this girl. I can tell you I hit her because I saw CCTV when I went to the solicitors and stuff, but I don't remember hitting her. The next thing I remember is being dragged like away and saying stop, kind of thing, by I think it was a DJ at the time. And that's when I kind of realized, oh my God, like I had like I was bleeding, you know, I couldn't see the girl. And, you know, I remember everyone saying to me, like, you need to run, the police is coming. And I was like, you don't run away from the police. That's guilty people. Guilty people run away. That they attacked us. I'm going to talk to the police. Like, it's fine. I was obviously wrong. I went and spoke to the police officer, and I was very, very like forthcoming. I was like, hello, hi. You know, it wasn't like, oh my God, the police might arrest me. I was like, hello, hi. Yes. Yeah, we did have a fight. You know, I was very forthcoming with this information. And I remember it did seem like the officer kind of understood me, and she was talking to me very like politely, you know, and I didn't have the, oh, the officer's dragging me around, or, you know, no, she was really polite. And I remember even when she said that I'm going to have to arrest you, she said it very politely. She was like, you know, Brenda, at this moment, I'm going to have to arrest you for GBH. And I think that's the moment I thought, hold on, GBH, isn't that like a whole prison sentence? You know, I didn't know the law in that way, but all I knew is GBH is quite serious. So what's going on? And they arrested me in that.
GBH stands for grievous bodily harm, right?
Yeah. But in my head, I didn't connect the dots. I was just like, no, this is a prison sentence. This is jail. So yeah, I was arrested. I honestly don't feel like the officers were bad. They really did speak to me. And I remember sitting in a van going, so just so I know, right? I mean, I've been looking into like policing and stuff, and I'm guessing I can't apply to be a police officer now, can I? And they were like, oh my God, no. They were like, well, hopefully you know, you don't get charged, and maybe you could apply. You seem like a lovely woman. And I was like, okay, thank you. You know, and
when you were in the police station, you obviously, there came a point where what happened in the club registered, you know, being arrested for GBH, were you charged with GBH? And what did you discover you had done?
So when I was in the police station, first things first, the cells. I remember the ceiling, and I remember trying really hard not to look at the ceiling, because it says, are you sick and tired of being sick and tired? And I was sick and tired of reading that, because every time I'd look up, I would actually read it, you know, and I'm like, oh, why am I reading it again? You know, and I remember I didn't have a solicitor at the time. So I got a duty solicitor. And I remember her explaining, you know, because I obviously hit her. I had a glass in my hand, so obviously she got hit with a glass, which cut me and cut her. But at the time, I had a cut, and I was saying, how did I get this cut then? And they were like, basically, the woman was like, so obviously you had something in your hand. Did you have a drink in your hand? I went, yes, I did. I had a glass in my hand, which I poured on her. And she went, okay, do you remember what you did after that? And I said, no. So she had been given all this information, and she explained that the girl was in the hospital, and she had like cuts to her face. I do remember them actually saying to me, if the glass had cut her anywhere else, like near her neck, I would have been arrested and charged for attempted murder. Now, that really got to me, because I ain't trying to kill nobody, and that's not how I'm brought up. Like, we don't do things like this. But in that moment, I remember going, okay, I'm so sorry. And I remember crying to the solicitor because I was like, I'm so sorry, but like, what would have happened if they killed my sister? I don't understand. And she couldn't answer that question, because for me, it was like, that was my sister. That's somebody that I've just now reconnected with, somebody that I'm trying to build a relationship. And I feel like in that moment, looking back at it now, especially with therapy and everything, I think that I saw it as my family being ripped away in that second. And I just fought. And probably carrying a lot of anger from the old relationship that I had and all this other stuff that I had going on mentally. I think because I'm always so happy, eventually the happiness has to stop, you know, that the joy, there's pain inside, and it has to come out one way. And when they charged me with GBH, they actually charged me with GBH section 18. And they told me about, you know, possibly going to prison. I'll be honest with you, Raphael, in that moment, I just kind of thought already I'm going to jail. Like, there was no, like, I remember loads of people saying to me, no, it's fine. You know, it's a first time offense, and, you know, you're a female and you're going to be fine. And I didn't see it like that. You know, when I saw the CCTV, it does look like I just walked over there and hit her. Do you understand? Like, so for me, I was like, well, I'm going to jail. This is it. I'm going to prison. I'm going to prison. I remember when they gave me the CCTV, they said to me, obviously, we don't want to find this on YouTube or anything like that, like on internet. And I said to her, do you think I want this on the internet? Like, I'm dying right now. I don't even want to look at it. You know, it's just that they made me watch it because it was like, so I can talk about it. But honestly, Raphael, for me to see that, it was like, nah, I can't. I wouldn't be brave enough to even put that on social media, because actually, when you look at it, it looks like I literally am just hitting and hitting and hitting. And that's probably what happened in regards to I hit her until whatever I had in my hand stopped, like broke. And then I just carried on hitting her. And that's a lot of anger. Do you know what I mean? That's a lot of anger. And that's a lot of things that I had to also understand. Where did that anger come from? Where did it all kind of rise from? What possessed me really to be so hurtful? But then again, I have to reflect on the simple fact that we see crime every single day, and half of the people that are in the situation don't plan to be in a situation. And I really have to reflect back on the fact that if my sister was, you know, I didn't want to be the person that goes home and tells my mum that my sister was dead and I was with her, if that makes sense. And that we was coming to a time where this is just people fighting, people have weapons, and this is what it is. And I remember just thinking, you know what? I really protected my mum. I wanted to protect her. And to be honest, that's who I was most afraid of. I wasn't afraid of the justice system. I wasn't afraid of anything else. I was afraid of my mum. And I remember even when they charged me and let me go, because they gave me bail. So I got to go home. And I remember my sister picking me up, and I said to her, does mum know I'm here? And she said, yeah, she's going to meet us at your house. And I remember, like, you know, just the journey home was like, oh my God, like, you know, just, you know, forget that I've even been at the police station, forget that the police are telling me off. I had to go and sit down with my mother and now explain why I did what I did. And honestly, when I sat down with her, I remember I was shocked, because my mum, she did say to me, look, yes, they arrested you. She said, I don't think you're going to go to jail. She said, but what was you meant to do? You know, Brenna, what was you meant to do? I've taught you guys to look after each other. And if your sister has a problem or she's being attacked, you're going to defend her. She's like, so I feel like we can fight this case. And my mum was very adamant that we're going to fight this case. It's self-defense. And, you know, we're going to do this. But unfortunately for her, she was wrong too. Do you know what I mean? So I think one thing that did happen, and one thing that I have realized after prison, there's an amazing lady called Cecilia. She's a solicitor. She's an amazing solicitor.
Brenda, before you talk to me about after prison, there come a point when you stood in the dock. Did you plead guilty and take responsibility for what happened?
I pled guilty even from the police station. I said, yes, I did. I hit, like, I never denied not once that I put a hand on this woman. I owned up. I was like, I was really, like, I owned up to everything. Like, there was, I think because I wasn't, like, streetwise, crime-wise, there was no, like, way to kind of spin the story, if that makes sense. You know, when you've been involved in crime, you could say, well, this happened and da, 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 and you have you know how to word things. I didn't have that, Raphael. I was just like, yeah, I did it. And I really said, okay, this is what happened. We was in the night, you know, I broke it down word for word. There was no like, there was no time for me to make something up or whatever. I owned up straight away, because they, when they asked me, did you hit this woman? I said, yes, I did that. But this is the reason why. And I was trying to explain that reason. But obviously by that time, it's already gone above, you know, CPS, and everything's been taken forward. So I know the women did drop the charges, from what I remember, that they actually dropped the charges and didn't want to take it forward. But CPS was the one that kind of pushed for it to go forward. But yeah, I owned up to it.
You took responsibility. You pled guilty at the court. What was the damage? Was the damage to the other girl superficial, or are we talking, you know, sort of scarring of a serious nature? Because you then get sentenced, and tell me about that.
They said she had scarring from when I, because I saw a picture and she had like a bandage thing on her face. I mean, I know that it was like the scars are like, they're still scars, but they're not like, they're not massive, if that makes sense. Because I know people have, she's Ugandan, I'm Ugandan, she goes to clubs that I mean, I don't go to these clubs, but she's gone out and people have seen her and she looks fine, if that makes sense. But obviously that's traumatic for her. Looking in a mirror, that's traumatic for her. So I can relate to that. But that's all I know in regards to her scarring. But yeah, like, what was the last question, actually?
You pleaded guilty and you were sentenced. What was your sentence? And then just talk to me a little bit about, you know, your journey through prison.
So I pled guilty. Originally, I remember my solicitor was saying I was looking at 3 to 5 years. GBH Section 18 had changed, the law had changed, because obviously there was so much more knife crime, and I think they upped it. So I kind of fell into that category. I got sentenced to 2.5 years, so 11 months inside, and then I managed to do fight. Like, I got out early, so I got tag, and I'd done 5 months on tag.
What was it like in prison for you, Brenda? Because, you know, up until your early teens, you were living this kind of ambitious life with a path, with a journey. Things went slightly wrong. This incident happened in a nightclub. You'd never been in trouble with the police before, apart from your kind of road riding bicycle at 11 years old. But here you are being taken from the dock down the steps to go to prison for the first time. And you mentioned at the very beginning of this how scared you were going to prison. How did you cope in prison? And, you know, people will rightly say that what you did deserved prison sentence, maybe. So you go to prison, you're being punished. How was it for you in prison? Did you feel that the punishment extended beyond the actual sentence? Because, you know, there's this fine line, isn't there, between... you're getting 2.5 years. That's the punishment for the crime that you committed. But what happens to you when you get into prison? How did that manifest for you?
What I would say, Raphael, is while I was on bail, there was a lot of stuff going on. So I think I lost Brenda from when I was still on bail. What people don't understand is that this fight happened. It was one day, but continuous after that, I was getting phone calls from these women. I was being threatened. I was being told that I was going to get shot if I go to certain areas. And I was really starting to lose my mind, because I never had this kind of issues. Like, I avoided gangs, I avoided certain situations. So for me to now be on bail with a pending sentence, and then being threatened with, you know, by these girls saying this and that, you know, I was getting phone calls every other day. And it got to the point where I started, like, my friend basically said, you need to start recording these calls, because you're getting really angry, Brenda. I've never seen you like this. You're getting really angry and I don't know what to say to you. And I was losing my damn mind. Like, I was literally like, I am the one facing a sentence. They attacked us. And now I could possibly get longer, because, like, what if I bump into these girls and we end up fighting again? And I actually remember going to the police station. I managed to record the girl saying that, you know, if I'm standing in a certain area, she's made a sound effect. And I said, what does that mean? And she said, you'll be dead. You know, that's it. And she talks about guns and all this stuff in the recording. And I took it to the police station and I said, I really need you to help me. I've been arrested a couple of months ago now. I'm back and forth in court. I'm getting harassed by the girls that, you know, these are women at the time. I was 20. And I was like, that, you know, can you listen to this recording? They're saying they're going to shoot me. You know, like, I need to know that I feel safe. And also, if, say, for example, I go somewhere and they're there and we end up fighting again, I don't want you to think that I'm just a continuous, you know, just out here going and fighting people. The lady did listen to it. There was a few things that she heard, but she said that the recording wasn't as clear. I could, as clear as day, hear gunshot dead in the recording. And she basically said to me that once my case was handled, then I can bring up charges against these women. And I'll be honest, I left that police station feeling alone. I left that police station feeling like my life was really just worth nothing. All the stuff that I'd done prior meant nothing. All the, you know, the joy and the smiles, all of that disappeared. The smiley Brenda, the no more, the sipping champagne Brenda was gone. I was just drinking, you know, to get drunk. I was drinking. I would get angry. You know, I was on edge. So by the time I got sentenced, I don't think I was me anymore. I wasn't spiritually, I wasn't there. I wasn't praying anymore. I had no faith. I had no faith in the system. I had no faith in my family. I had no faith in anyone. I didn't even have faith in myself. So by the time they sentenced me and I walked down those steps, you know, one of my poems said that it says, you know, I left her behind. I left her at the steps. You know, I left the old Brenda at the steps. You know, I didn't even turn around to say goodbye to her. I walked down them steps, a new person, a person that was angry, a person that did not care for life, and a person that really just felt alone. So being in the cells, I remember the solicitor bringing this piece of paper, and that had like my sister's number and her house address, my best friend's number and her house address. And I think that's the moment it also hit me even more. Like, this is, I have to now write to these people. There's no more phone calls. There's no more house visits. That's done, you know. And it was something happened. I don't think I had any feelings in that moment. There was nothing happening. I cried, you know, like there was constant tears. Like, it was so much tears that I didn't even know where they were coming from. Like, I didn't know I could cry so much, but there was no sound. It was just constant tears. And by the time they put me in the van, I was basically all cried out. And I remember listening to Magic. And I'm an old soul. Like, I love old school, like, you know, old music. Like, you know, all this new stuff, I don't know. I it takes me a while to catch up. But old stuff, you play that and I'm singing. And I remember them playing like Magic, and a song came on. And I think it's Now I'm Easy. Easy like Sunday morning, you know. And I started singing, you know, out loud. And I remember one of the off, like the people driving must have, like, they were laughing. And I'm now looking back, I think they probably thought, oh, she's used to this. This is a regular thing for her. But it was coping. I was trying to understand what was happening, because I had left Brenda. I didn't know who I was anymore. And, you know, that song is playing, it's evening. It was, you know, dark, and we're passing like North London, Islington, you know, bars and clubs and restaurants, and people are sitting down and, you know, living their life. And I remember thinking, that's it. My life, I would never get to do that again. I won't be able to sit down and have a drink. I won't be able to have a meal. This is it. It's finished. And so by the time I got to Holloway, it was like an empty person was being sentenced. It was like whoever that person was, she weren't Brenda. She weren't Lady Unchained. She was just a ghost of a person. And like I said, I used to wear weave. They took my wig off. And that was another part of my identity kind of just being ripped apart. And then I remember always saying, like, when they checked me in, I remember saying, well, don't cry. Don't show any emotions, you know, because you can't cry here. This is where bad people go. You can't cry here. You have to be bad now. You have to be tougher. And honestly, I remember you get that one first phone call without the PIN and stuff, that free phone call. And I called my sister. And as soon as I spoke to her, I cried. But I was trying to speak my language. So I speak my language fluently. So I can speak Luganda very, very well. And I was trying to talk in Luganda so that everybody else didn't hear me. But what I didn't know was that there was actually a Ugandan woman working on servery. So she overheard me and she kind of came and supported me a little bit. But to be honest with you, even though I had that support, what I found is that women in prison are very supportive. They do look after you. It's not like the films. It's not like Bad Girls or Wentworth. You know, they really are supportive. But again, I wasn't me anymore. And it got to the point where I basically decided that enough was enough. And I decided that I wasn't going to finish the sentence. And that meant me dying, because I felt like the only way I can be free from this pain, from this life, was to die, because there was nothing left for me. You know, all the qualifications I'd done, all the experience I had, you know, that was irrelevant now, because I'm a criminal and criminals either deserve to be here or dead. You know, and I was very hard on myself. And I remember speaking to somebody and kind of saying, well, you know, there's no point really. I think I put in an application because I looked at the end date, you know, when they give you the form when you first get in and it's like your name, your prison number, your start date, your end date. And I looked at the end date, and obviously if I didn't get tagged, it would have been like the following year in May. And I couldn't do it. I put in a request and I said, is there any way we can talk to the judge? Like, is it the child in me, you know, is there any way we can talk to the judge? I think there might have been a mistake, you know, please look into this, get back to me when you can. And I remember that was the quickest application response I got, you know, in jail. It came back and they were like, no, there's nothing we could do. And that was it. That was the decision.
I appreciate that, you know, going to prison, the enormity of what you're about to go through. But when you say, you know, Brenda had completely changed, you were dead inside, you were cold, etc., you were emotionless. Are we talking about you were thinking about taking your own life, or are you thinking about sort of moving up and down through the prison so bad that if anybody came at you in a violent way, that you didn't care that you could lose your life in a violent situation?
No, I was taking, ready to take my own life, like just end it. And I made plans that, you know, I started collecting medication and, you know, just really, really thinking how this will work. But I guess something in me, something changed. I do remember my sister and my best friend coming to see me. And I remember I'd said to them, when I get to jail, I'm going to have to cane in my hair, I'm going to have to be tough, and I'm going to have to look like a bad girl. And, you know, by the time they got there, I did have my hair cane in, because my wig was taken. So I had no option but to cane in my hair. It wasn't a plan. And I remember them being so happy to see me and me kind of just being so still. And they were trying to ask me all these questions. And I just remember saying to them, don't come back here, okay? And they were like, what do you mean? Like, are they moving you already? And I said, no, I just won't be here. And they went, oh, so where are you going to be? And I said, well, I just won't be here. And that was me trying to say goodbye to them. You know, that was me trying to say, you know, and I remember saying to them, you know, my best friend was like, Brenda, you can't, like, you've been through so much. Like, you can do this. I know it's hard, but you can do this. You can do this, Brenda. Like, you shouldn't be here, but you can do this. And I remember hearing a lot of sounds coming from them, but really not listening to them, because in my heart, I had already decided that this is not the way that Brenda should live. This is not the life that I was meant to live. And I was really, really ready to just end it completely. Something did happen. My best friend, obviously, after that, sent me a letter, and it would have been the first letter I received in prison. I'd learned quickly that you have to go and collect your food quick, otherwise it might not be there, and you eat whatever's given to you. So I remember going to collect food, and I had got this letter from my best friend. So I read like four lines, and then they called for food. And so I went to collect my food, sat down, ate my food. I remember going to the sink to wash my plate and turning around towards my bed. And the next thing I know is that I open my eyes. I'm on the floor. There's like all these doctors standing over me. Before this time, I was literally putting my hand on the Bible and saying, you know, to God, do your best in it. You're the creator. So take me away. You created me, so remove me from this situation. And I'll put my hand on the Bible, and I would even threaten him, like, if you don't, I'm just going to start praying to Allah, and I'm not going to pray to you no more. You know, this is like me really having nothing. So when I open my eyes and there's like doctors, and you know, Raphael, in a prison, you don't, to see a doctor or a nurse, it's an application. You might get to see someone, it might not be the best person. So for me to open my eyes and look up and there's like all these doctors and nurses, I'm like, whoa, what's going on? Like, you know, I'm looking around like, what's happening? I'm trying to get up, and they're like, you know, take it easy. And I'm like, look, what's going on? Where's the letter? Where's my letter? And they had confiscated that letter because they thought it was a suicide note. And I didn't know that. So they had to take me separately into another room. And I remember the nurse asking me, did you take anything? you know, did someone give you a roll up? Have you taken anything from any other inmate? And I said, no, I haven't taken anything. I just want my letter back. And they said, we can't give you the letter. You know, we've got to read it over. We've got to check. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, Brenda, you had no pulse. Like, your heart stopped beating. We called a cold red, a cold blue, a cold, like, we called every code. You was not here, you know? And I'm like, what do you mean I wasn't here? Like, and they're like, that's why we're asking you if you took something. We took the letter because we thought it was a suicide note. You was not here, you know? And I think for me, that happening was what really kind of woke me up a little bit.
What had happened? I know you said earlier that you were piling up medication. Had you taken that medication or had you just...
I hadn't taken it.
You just collapsed. Your body had given up on you.
I just collapsed. I literally just collapsed.
The pressure and the weight of everything that you'd been through had taken your physicalness away from you.
Yeah, I just collapsed.
Was that the turning point, Brenda? Was that the moment where you decided that you were going to change your life or your situation? And was it?
It was definitely a massive turning point for me, because up until that point, you know, they would call for church and I remember laughing at them, like, praying here, like, God's not here. It's like, this is all the evil people. Like, I don't want to pray with evil people. So I would never go to church. And I actually remember being very disrespectful to a priest, you know, a black priest at that, a black female priest at that. And I remember just saying, don't talk to me here. You know, don't do it. I remember because I saw her and I remember going, she better not talk to me. You know, she better not. There's so many people here. Do not talk to me. And she came straight to me. And I was like, go away. Like, you know, when I'm in jail, like once someone starts shouting, everyone's like, oh, the rude girl, she's getting rude to the priest. Oh, bad girl, bad girl. Like, and I didn't care about that. I just didn't want the priest to talk to me because me and God had lost our relationship. So she was a symbol of God and I didn't want nothing to do with her. So after that particular time when I collapsed, I remember the next day, I think it was the next day or that same week, Sunday, they called for church. And honestly, I think even the officer was like, oh, you're dressed. I was like, yeah, I'm going to church. He was like, oh, okay, coming in, you know. And I did walk in back into the church, the chapel in Holloway, for the first time even. I think like the first time I went there was induction. And then I walked there this time and I saw that priest, the black lady, and I just fell into her arms. I don't know how to explain it, but I feel like my prison sentence, it was meant to happen. It was meant to happen. It was written somewhere, you know, that it was meant to happen like that. Because to be honest with you, that moment is just a moment that you think, maybe there's a reason why I'm here. Because even before church, I started singing every gospel song that I could remember in my little life of being in church. And I sang them in the shower and I remember one of the women going, don't give up your day job, love. And when we got to the church and I hugged the lady and she said, look, God already forgave you. I forgave you. Like, you know, it's fine. And I was like, no, but I was so rude to you. Like, and I was crying at this point. Like, I had forgotten about all the other women in this place. I've forgotten about not showing tears and not showing sadness. And I cried my eyes out. And I remember being in that service and they brought in a choir, outside choir. And I kid you not, every single song that I was trying to sing in my best church voice in the shower, this choir sang those songs. And I remember sitting in the church and looking around going, okay, God, I understand. I get it now. I am meant to be here, but please show me what it is that you want me to do here because I don't know. You know, I don't know what I should be doing. And after that, I think things started to get a bit better. You know, I got a job at reception. I looked at education. I remember at one point looking at knitting. So I was like, where else would I learn how to knit? You know, and then kind of completely left that and said, you know what, let me see. I've done GCSEs already. I've done like some A-levels. And I remember going to English, meeting this black lady, the teacher. And she said, oh, this is A-level English. And I said, oh, well, I've got like GCSE English. Does that count? And she said, well, it counts for something. I don't really get a lot of people that's done their GCSEs here. So, you know, she said, sit down, write me a story. And I said, what do you want me to write about? And she said, write about prison. And I said, that's not really fair, is it? So I'm in jail. And she went, just write about it. Just whatever comes to your mind, write about it. And I remember sitting there writing as much as I could. And then literally by the end of the lesson, she read it back to me. And she corrected it. It had like loads of red pens. Like grammar was crap. and she went, I think you're a good writer. I'm going to set you onto the course. And I did A-level English and I passed. And I think this time, this is when, you know, for me, things were starting to, I was starting to understand the routine. You know, I'd become more friendly with women. I started to, you know, people saw me doing my hair and they were like, hey, you do hair? Like, do my hair, man. I'll buy you some backy. Do my hair. I'll buy you some this. I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Why not? You know, like, you know, getting into the, you know, I'll do your hair. You get me something on canteen. All of this stuff that I, you know, I was kind of trying to stay away from. I ended up getting a single cell in Holloway, which is, you know, that doesn't happen. So I know mentally I must have been completely mad. so I got a single cell and things just started to move a little bit smoother. You know, I remember healthcare, there was a lady in healthcare that allowed me to just come to healthcare and cry. So I wouldn't cry everywhere else, but I would go to healthcare and I would just cry. You know, she would, you'd get that slip under your door, you got an appointment at healthcare and I knew that was my appointment to cry. So I'd go there and I'd cry with her. and she would just give me a coffee, you know, she'll give me a hug and I'd leave. I'll go back to my cell and just be like, yep, let's continue this sentence. But a lot of things started to happen, but I had also started to make friends who were being transferred to different jails. And obviously everyone was saying to me, oh, this is a, unless you're a lifer or you're on remand, you do get moved on. And I didn't know that, you know, so I was learning that even though I was getting comfortable, I was about to have to move on and go to another jail. And at the time, a lot of people were going to Moulton Hall, and that jail was a foreign national prison for women at the time. And I remember people that were going there to me seemed British, you know, and I didn't really understand why they were going there. And a part of me did start to think, oh God, I mean, everyone's a criminal in here. So they must be lying about having, you know, a passport, you know, like the judgmental side of me. This is me, Brenda, starting to come back again. She's starting to remember that people are criminals and people lie, you know. And I had a lot of friends that went there that wrote to me and told me about it. You know how letters are in jail. You know, if you want to tell somebody something, you just leave a space and you kind of understand, you read between the lines that something is not correct in this jail. So I knew there was problems there. And of course, lo and behold, I got the knock on the door and the officer said, pack your stuff. You know, you're being transferred to Moulton Hall in the morning. And I remember like saying, Miss, there has to be a mistake. I'm British, you know. And she went, I don't know about all of that, but you've come up on the list. You're getting taken to Moulton Hall tomorrow morning, so pack up. And I said, Miss, I can't go there, though. It's a foreign national prison. Like, I can't go there. Like, and it's far. Like, I can't go there. And she basically said, if I don't go, I basically will get taken to the block for basically refusing orders. And I had never been to the block, Raphael. Like, I felt like the prison cell that I was in was the block. Like, that was the block enough for me. I don't need to. And I said, okay, I'll pack my stuff. And I remember packing my stuff and crying my eyes out. And I remember women, and this is, again, the support of women, the support of, you know, people that is behind bars. I remember people banging on their doors and coming to the window and they're like, go to the window. And I'm at the window crying. And they're like, Brenda, it's going to be all right. This person's there. That person's there. This person there. I was like, yeah, but why? Why are they sending me there? Like, are they going to try and deport me? Well, how can they deport me? I've got a passport. No, like, Brenda, it's fine. Don't worry about it. And I remember, even though they were being so nice, I remember in that moment thinking, oh God, do they think I'm lying about my passport as well? Like, just like what I thought about it.
The full circle had come round. We don't have that much time left, Brenda, but you've talked, when you went to Moulton Hall, I mean, I suppose the end of your story, it's not the end of your story, you're still on an amazing journey. But I suppose the big pivot point was when you discovered poetry. I mean, you met this teacher who took you onto the course and you started to craft your skill in writing. And that's led to who you are, Unchained Poetry. That's about you today. And I'm sorry to kind of bring this to that point, but I'm conscious of our time. Unchained Poetry, how did that start and where is it at now?
Unchained Poetry started off with a friend sending me an application to create a project or a business idea that works with people that have been to prison or coming from challenging backgrounds. And so it was like a Dragon's Den kind of thing. And I remember it was the first time I had to actually write, because I had the idea of Unchained already, but I'd never written it out, which is funny because I'm a writer. I should enjoy writing. But I guess when you leave jail, it's like, oh, God, I've been writing for so many months, you know.
You hadn't been writing poetry when you were in prison. It was only when you left prison?
I would say notes in prison. In prison, they were just notes. They were just a way to, I guess, cope with other, you know, people that did want to actually fight me in jail or officers that were acting a certain way towards me. In that moment, I didn't see it as poetry. The only time it became some kind of poem is at the end of my prison sentence when I'd done restorative justice, so sycamore tree, and you have to create something that signifies forgiveness. And I basically just went in my book that I had all these notes and I kind of put all these little bits together. And I created this piece, which is actually now going to be in a book, my book that's published next year. And it was called, I think, A Thin Line Between Good and Bad, because, you know, by now I'd realized that because my whole prison sentence, most of it was me being angry with myself and, you know, being really upset with me letting me down. And that poem kind of signifies, you know, you can go from a good person to a bad person in a matter of seconds. You know, it's not hard. Anybody can do it. But it's how do I then become that good person again? And that's what the poem was about. So that was the first piece of poetry that I wrote. But then when I got out, there was no like poetry. I was like, I'm not a poet. Like, you know, I remember people actually really seeing some of my writing and I was like, no, that's not poetry. Shh, don't tell people I write. You know, don't tell. And also because I wasn't confident with my grammar still. So it was, for me, it's like people reading, I write backwards. So whenever I start writing, I write a poem, I can say I'm writing, this is the beginning. By the time I get to the end, I've realized that the end is actually the beginning and the beginning is the end. You know, if someone reads it, they won't understand it because by the time I perform it, it don't sound like how it's written, if that makes sense. So it was literally trying to find myself. And I remember when I applied for this opportunity, I wanted Unchained Poetry to be a mentoring program. You know, I wanted to create more, you know, ex-offenders that have been to jail and turn them into positive role models, you know, so that we can create more positive ex-offender role models so that they can then start working with people coming out of jail and basically for them to have a mentor that has already been through that journey and how to get to where that person was. Of course, I didn't get that. I got to top 10, but you had to make it to top 5 to get the funding. So I never got the funding. And I thought, you know what? It's written out now. It's on paper. Let me just carry on. And it really was my friends coming to my house, doing little sessions and, you know, let's write. What does Unchained mean to you? But the problem is most of my friends hadn't been to jail. So it would always be me talking and, you know, about my prison because they were so fascinated about my prison sentence, you know. So it became a thing where I realized that I needed to carry this on my own for a minute, just as Brenda. And hopefully when I meet these artists that have been to jail, I would have already kind of been in a position to be able to help them and guide them. And really and truly, it wasn't until I met Joel Taylor, who told me about National Prison Radio, because when I was in jail, National Prison Radio wasn't as big as it was. So it was just growing. So I didn't actually know about National Prison Radio. I knew about Kersler, I knew about Women in Prison, but I didn't know about National Prison Radio. So before actually going to National Prison Radio, I started going to open mics. And again, not knowing, like, I'll be honest, I went to open mics and I would invite all my friends, come, I'm going to perform. And if no one showed up, Raphael, I wouldn't perform. You know, I remember them going, Brenda, next is Brenda. And I'm like looking with everyone like, where is Brenda? Where is this girl? You know, so it's been a journey because now I can go to an event and it doesn't matter if I don't know no one or I didn't go with anybody. I'm going to meet people and I'm going to talk to them. And that's, I guess, the confidence that I've felt through, I guess, National Prison Radio putting me on, you know, their first ever conference and inviting me and saying, we want you to perform. You know, before that, they put me on a show outside in all about positive role models after prison. You know, I met the co-hosts, the presenters, two guys who have been to jail. And it fascinated me. You know, I'm like, we're in broadcasting house. Do they know you've got a criminal record? Are you sure? Like, what? Like, are we allowed to be here? You know, they're like, yeah, of course we're allowed to be here. Like, you know, it was just meeting people that were like me that have been to jail and are working, you know, and that fascinated me because in my head, I'd never, this is what I wanted. I wanted to meet more people that's been to jail. And of course, you know, hearing about your story, the first conference I went to, that's when I heard about your story. And I was like, what is going on? What is life really? You know, and I think I even actually spoke to you and I was like, oh my God, like, hello, thank you so much. You know, just fascinated. And I think being a part of National Prison Radio allowed me to meet, you know, more ex-offenders who are doing amazing work. And it kind of pushed me even more to push myself, you know, to show myself that actually there's people like Raphael Rule that are like on BBC, that these are big people, you know, like, why did you in your head even for a second believe that this was going to hold you back? You need to do this and don't worry about anything else. The people that you need to work with will find you, you know, and that's how Unchained Nights came along, because Unchained Nights is, you know, the night that showcases all the talent of artists with lived experience, you know. So I had like people contacting me through Arts Admin and saying, I want to perform at your event, you know, and I'm now a manager apparently, and I'm getting these phone calls and I'm like, okay, so you got bars, what's your bars, what are you talking about, like send me some memos, I don't care if it's not professional, I'm not professional, send it to me on WhatsApp, you know. And they sent me stuff, and I remember one artist in particular had like a line that he said that I just wasn't comfortable with, and I said, look, I love your flow, definitely wanting to perform, but see that line, it's gonna have to come out, mate, I'm so sorry. And I remember him going, do you know what, Brenda? I'm so sorry that I wrote that when I was like 16, 17 years old. I'm a big man now. Like, obviously, I don't write like that, you know. So it was like meeting all these guys, you know, that all of a sudden, you know, because I had now been performing. I had been now getting books, like bookings and stuff. And it was amazing. But these guys had never had this. You know, I put them on a stage and I called them after going, can I get your bank account details and that? Would you need my bank account details for? You know, very standoffish. I was like, I need to pay you for performing. They're like, oh my days, for real. This has never happened to me. You're paying me to tell my story, like my bars that I wrote in jail. And I'm like, yeah, we're going to do this. And we're going to create more, you know, ex-offenders that, you know, want to tell this story, that want to be in the spotlight so that maybe, just maybe, people that are out here, even the younger boys that are listening to certain music that glorify certain things, maybe, just maybe, they can be like us and we can make being out of jail and staying out of jail look cool. How about that? You know, how about we're the ones that create this new change that actually people don't want to go to jail. People actually want to, we can go straight to Unchained Poetry and we're going to work with them and we're going to help young people. We don't have to go to jail to do that. Do you know what I'm saying? So this is why I think now I'm expanding in regards to working with Youth Offending Service, working with, you know, one of my artists who never went to jail, but also kind of exploring the journeys of what happens, you know, children in care. How do we help them not end up in jail? You know, we are very aware that people in care end up in prison, a lot of them. And it's one of those things where it's like, how do we prevent that? So for me, Unchained Poetry and Unchained Nights has been the making of Lady Unchained. And also the name Lady Unchained actually came from that first broadcasting house interview with Hillary and Clinton, not to be mistaken for the president. You know, and they actually, well, to be honest, I was meant to be on the show and they were meant to play my poem in Raphael. I wasn't meant to perform it live. And they went, so we've got a poem from Brenda, right? And I said, oh, you're going to play it in now, yeah? And I'm sitting there and they're like, no, you're going to perform it. And I went, what? And so I performed Track Queen. And I remember like looking at them and they were like, oh my God, like, you know, and they went, Unchained Poetry, Lady Unchained. I went, ooh, I like that name. I like that name. You know, so that's basically where Lady Unchained came from. But yeah, Unchained Nights right now, we're growing. Unchained Poetry is growing. And I think for me, it's the joy of it is, you know, because I do National Prison Radio, the joy of going into a jail and having people know my voice, you know, those are the people, because that's who I need. That's who I need to understand what I do, how I do it, and why, you know, why I'm doing what I'm doing. So to walk in and I say,
I suppose that's you now inspiring people based on this long journey, or, you know, this journey that you've been on, and that inspiration is now showing fruition. My final question, Brenda, is, and everything you've said about Unchained Nights, Unchained Poetry, your own journey, you know, works with my theme of this podcast, Second Chance. So my final question to you briefly is, what does Second Chance mean to you and for you to other people?
A second chance to me, it just firstly means a lot, can I just say, but a second chance, I think people want a second chance, but I think for me, you have to give yourself that second chance, because if you don't give yourself that second chance, even if somebody gives you a second chance, you know, if someone brings an opportunity that is very fruitful for you and can bring you joy, you won't take it, and you won't manage to bring the joy that you want to bring to it, because you haven't given yourself that chance. You know, I remember being that person where I was given opportunities and I would either turn them down or I'll just not, you know, I'll do them rubbish because I wasn't ready. And I hadn't given myself, I hadn't given Brenda that chance to say that I am worth being given a second chance. So I think a second chance has to start with the individual. Once you give yourself that second chance and you say, actually, I deserve good things and I, you know, I can show change, you know, I think people will just open doors for you. But if you're still in a situation where you're not sure, you're still confused, you know, you don't know where you're going, it's hard to get that second chance because people can give you these opportunities, but you just won't take them because you're just not ready. So for me, I think a second chance and for the people I work with is, that's the one thing I do. It all starts with you believing in yourself, giving yourself that self-love, that self-care, you know, volunteering and showing yourself that you're worth doing certain jobs and building a name for yourself in a different way. You know, I think that is what a second chance is. And if it has to start with you. If it doesn't start with you, no matter what people throw at you, you're going to swerve it all the time. So I think, yeah, second chances, honestly, you start with that individual. And honestly, once you see that and believe it in yourself, it will be hard for other people to not see it in you. It'll be very hard.
Brenda, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your story. I'm tempted to say, oh, go on, give us a little poem, but that's unfair. And I would encourage people to go along to one of your nights, not where just you're performing, but some of your artists, etc. So if people want to do that, people want to find out more about you, about the work that you're doing, maybe even people that are listening to this who think that they have the talent that could collaborate with you, how can they connect with you, Brenda?
So you can find me on Twitter at Unchained Poetry. You can find me on Instagram at Lady Unchained, or I've got a website and that's at unchainedpoetry.com. So all of my information is there and you can get involved. There's a contact me page there. So you can definitely get involved and just listen. If you think that you've got the talent to do this, it starts with you again. Like, contact us. Let's get you on a stage. Let's get you on a mic. But we just don't glorify stuff. That's all I ask. Keep it clean.
Brenda, thank you so much for coming on. You're a star. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Raphael. I'll speak to you soon.
I hope you found Brenda's story inspirational and testimony that life after prison can be successful and not something that defines who you are, even if the experience helps to shape the person you go on to be. Thanks for listening to this episode, and please share it with your friends, family and colleagues. If you want to follow the show for updates about new episodes, just click on subscribe. Be a part of this podcast by rating and reviewing what you've heard, and tell us what you think. More importantly, tell others what you think by leaving some comments. This is an independent podcast, meaning we are doing this out of passion, not pay. But we do need support to pay for the production. So please, if you want to make a small donation, click on the support link in the description at the end. If you want to advertise your products or services on this show, please get in touch. If you want to connect, drop me a direct message via Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or any other means you have to make contact. Audio editing is by Audio Avalanche. The original music is by J-Ro Productions. The cover design work is by Studio Minerva. Our guest bookers are Sophie Warner and Lewis Hunt. This episode was produced by me, your host, Raphael Rowe.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.